Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
Tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Ontario's 38th Finance Minister, Peter Bethlenfalvy, will rise in the legislature and continue a tradition that started nearly 157 years ago. He'll unveil the province's budget for the upcoming fiscal year, essentially how Ontario plans to spend roughly $200 billion. Budget Day is almost always the single most important day on Queen's Park's political calendar. What goes into budget making? How much of it reflects what the finance minister wants versus the premier or his other cabinet colleagues? Well, we've got three former finance ministers here who have all the answers. So let's welcome, in chronological order, Ernie Eves, finance minister from 1995 to 2001, and of course, Ontario's 23rd premier. Janet Ecker, the first ever female finance minister in Ontario to bring in a budget. She had the job from 2002 to 2003. And Greg Sorbera, finance minister from 2003 to 2005, and then again from 2006 to 2007. And it's great to have you three, former treasurers and one former premier, here at our table today. I introduced in chronological order, so let's start in inverse chronological order. Take us back to the beginning of the budget-making process. He'll get up tomorrow and give the speech, but when did the actual crafting of the budget start?
Well, you know, Stephen, it almost starts the day after the last budget is presented.
I know everybody says that, but is that really true?
Well, about 6 months before budget day, you start to think about what's going to be in the budget. You have to realize that a budget, in Ontario's case, is really a presentation of all of the plans that the government has for that year and for a number of years to come. So it's a planning process that really takes a full year, but the actual work starts 5 or 6 months before it's presented.
Janet Ecker, at what point do you have a meeting with the premier and ask him, okay, is there a theme to this budget I should be following? Do you want to direct me in any particular way? Are you waiting to hear direction from me or et cetera?
Well, it's basically the government's telling its story. You know, what is its story? I mean, there's a lot of that, and that's as important, I think, as the actual financial statements in the document. But it's an iterative process. There's conversations certainly with a premier. Some premiers are, and I will let one premier here speak for himself, but some premiers are very directive. Others are, you know, you tell me what you would, you know, what you want to do, what you're thinking about. But it should be an iterative process. And the other thing that you should try and do, I think, and I know certainly from my first budget, because we had a couple of really challenging decisions to make, was we did a lot of consultation with caucus. We were actually more open with caucus, I think, than it happened previously, just because we wanted them to understand the challenges that we had. And they were very supportive of the decisions that we eventually ended up making in that particular budget.
Because so. You've done that legwork ahead
of time.
Yeah,
a little bit, yeah, yeah. Okay. So the consultation piece of it is really important, and that iterative process, I think, really makes a better budget at the end of the day.
So let's start with when you were finance minister and Mike Harris was the premier. Do you go to him and say, Mike, what do you want in this budget? Or shall I tell you? Or should you tell me? Or tell me. How did
all
it work?
Off the record. Well, off the record.
We had a quite interesting government when we first started, of course. We had the Barbary government deficit, and we had pledged during the campaign to eliminate that. And there were three controversial aspects to that, which we stood behind. So the very first economic statement I was permitted to give, I wasn't allowed to call it a budget because we had just been, literally became the government 3 weeks before that. Mind you, I didn't sleep much in those 3 weeks. It was like 24/7 for 3 weeks. We iterated what we wanted to do in the first year. And then the first budget I actually delivered, I think, was in the spring of 96. Mike and I had known each other for quite a while. I was fortunate because we had a great relationship. And we'd known each other for years before we got elected. We'd played golf together. He was in municipal politics in North Bay. He was on the Board of Education. We were both on the same riding association together, the Parry Sound Riding Association.
Where you eventually ran.
May surprise people to know Nipissing Township, where Mike came from, is actually in Parry Sound District. It's not in the district of Nipissing. However, Mike was very generous to me in terms of the only budget that his office actually looked through every single page on and every line on was my first one. And after that, I basically had free rein to do what I wanted in succeeding budgets, except that you get a call from the premier's office from time to time, like, we'd really like to perhaps see something about this and something like that. That does happen. I don't know if everybody's had that relationship that I was party to because of our great personal relationship.
Let me find out, because I think it's fair to say you did not have the longstanding relationship with Dalton McGuinty that he would have had with Ernie Eves. So when you're putting together that first budget, how much of it is, I'm the finance minister, I'm going to do what I want, and how much of it is, he's the premier, he's going to tell me what to do?
No, but Dalton and I worked very closely together. I mean, we had had the experience of rebuilding the party for almost 5 years after I became, or 4 years after I became president of the party. So we were working very closely together. And the budget process was really a project that he and I were very, very involved in. We knew that our first budget had to be about health care. We knew that in our first budget, we had to make a choice between continuing to run a deficit or introducing new taxes. Each of those things was a matter of breaking a political promise in the 2003 campaign, and we decided to raise taxes. But it was a decision that we worked on together. I remember bringing, I think, 4 or 5 proposals for new taxes to the premier's office, and we'd sit around and he would say, no, we're not doing that, so bring me something else. We finally landed on the Ontario health premium, which has been part of the tax structure of the Ontario government ever since that budget.
But was it him telling you, we're going to have to raise taxes, tell me how to do it? Or was it you telling him, if you want to fulfill all those commitments you made in the election campaign, we're going to have to raise taxes?
Well, it's the issue that we debated. And ultimately, we decided that it was going to be new taxes rather than not fulfilling the programmatic commitments, including health care, which is always in desperate need of new funding in Ontario.
I guess I should take, you were his finance minister, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's
reenact that.
That's exactly what I want to do. No. Did you ever go to him and say, we need more money, can I raise taxes?
Well, actually what we had to do in the first budget is, because what had happened was, and when you're thinking about budgets, you've got to think more than, and as you know, not just the first year or the second year, you know, you got to think about the challenges down the road. And we had gotten ourselves into a position where there was a tax cut coming of some, I think, $2 billion in the election year. And we're all sitting here going, okay, this is kind of cool, but in election year, people want to spend on new things. You want to have room to spend on new things for the campaign. So do we delay it? Do we cancel it? Do we delay it? Do we go forward with it? Worry about the challenge, you know, sort of a year later, whatever. And that was one of the things we talked to caucus about, was should we delay this? And it was as significant, I think, for us, given the political brand, as it was for you and the premier, when you had to say, yep, you know, we're going to break a promise. We're going to delay tax cuts a year, which in the time was seen as an incredible revolutionary thing. But it gave us a lot more flexibility in the next year or two to do things that you know you're going to want to do when you go into an election.
How much leeway did he give you to do what you wanted versus you taking direction from him?
Well, the challenge is, first of all, I mean, you know, I'd known Ernie all through our elected career, because I was elected in 95 with him. Well, he was there earlier with Mike. But, and also I'd supported him for leader, you know, so it wasn't like we didn't know each other at all, right? So, but again, it was, I think, an iterative process, as it should be. Yeah. I mean, there were things he wanted, there were things I wanted, and sometimes we argued about it, sometimes we didn't, and you just kind of saw off somewhere in the middle.
And how tempted were you to tell her what to do, given that you'd already brought in, what, 5, 6 budgets?
Five
budgets as finance minister.
Not counting the
economic statement. Right.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
You must have been tempted to want to tell her what to do, given that you'd had so much more experience at it.
Yes, he had.
No, actually, I wasn't tempted.
Is that true?
I probably had the benefit of, I think, one of the best deputy ministers of finance this province has ever seen.
Yeah, very much
by
so.
The name of Michael Gourlay, who unfortunately is no longer
the
with
late
us.
Great, yes indeed.
And he had like an idea a day. He reminded me, Hugh Siegel, he'd come into your office every morning and say, hey, I think we should do this. I said, Mike, we can't do that. It's politically not correct. You know, we can't do that. Okay, well, I'll be back tomorrow with another idea. And he sort of, I think, helped
Yeah, Michael was very
Janet
helpful.
And her staff through the budgetary process. So I had no concerns.
Yeah.
And I'd known Janet, of course, for quite a while. I actually knew her when she worked for Keith Norton. I don't know if you remember
that's
that.
Right, down in the Davis government. Yeah, that's right.
And I appointed her finance minister, but I didn't think that she was capable or up to the job. She wouldn't have been there.
You mentioned Bill Davis, and I want to go back to, there was a great movie made by Peter Raymond, documentary called The Art of the Possible,
yes.
In which he basically got, I don't know how he did it, but he got behind the scenes in the Bill Davis government days. So it was 70-something, and basically got into all kinds of private meetings about how the budget process worked. And one thing we learned is that when you put a budget together 45 years ago, the finance minister and ministry basically did it all, and Bill Davis walked in there the day before the budget was going to be announced and said, maybe tweak that a bit, tweak that a bit, and that was it. So here's what I want to know. How much of that went on when you were putting budgets together?
Well, it was really a project that involved the premier and myself directly. And
so lots of input from the premier's office.
We decided in each budget what the theme was going to be. In year one, it was health. In year two, it was post-secondary education. In year three, it was infrastructure. And in year four, it was social services to Ontario's most vulnerable populations. But those were decisions that really emerged with the premier coming out of cabinet. And cabinet was always supportive of those themes and played into those themes. But, you know, the actual work was driven by the public service, driven by the premier's office, and to a lesser extent, driven by the issues that caucus would bring up from time to time.
So what happens, like, there must have been a moment as this budget is being put together where Doug Ford told Peter Bethlenfalvy, look, I want this in there, and Peter Bethlenfalvy pushed back and said, well, if I do that, I'm not going to be able to do, right? Those conversations happen.
Yeah.
So tell me about something that happened when you were there where Dalton McGuinty said, I want this, and you said, well, I can't do that because if I do that, then I can't do this, and you want that too.
Well, there were, I go back to the first budget where we decided that we were going to raise taxes, and we brought proposals that we thought were reasonable. And he just, you know, together with his team just said, no, that's not going to work. We are not going to do that. So please come back with something else.
Do you remember what he rejected? What did you propose he rejected?
Steve, you're talking about 22 years ago?
So?
No, budget confidentiality. Yeah. That's,
no,
that's,
no,
that's,
no,
your, that's your excuse.
That's your card, yeah.
I remember that we were thinking about a slight increase in income taxes, a slight increase in corporate taxes. Going down the road, we had a real difficult battle on increasing the minimum wage. And I think this was in my final budget, and I was very concerned about the economic impact of increasing the minimum wage. And the premier and his office really wanted to move the yardsticks on minimum wage. And it was a battle that he won, and I'm glad he won it because we did the right thing. And his advice was better than the advice that I was getting from my bureaucrats.
What did you and Mike Harris cross swords on, where either he wanted something and you didn't want to do it or vice versa?
I don't think there's anything significant, but there were smaller things, for example.
Like what?
For example, the tax on horse racing in the province of Ontario. Everybody else had an entertainment tax of half of 1%. And the horse racing industry in Ontario, which was in danger of going out of business, had a tax rate of 5%, which was significantly higher than 0.5%.
Right.
And I went to Mike and said, you know, we got to make this playing field level. They're in the entertainment business. Oh, well, you know, how's that going to look if we give horse racing industry a tax break? And I said, well, it's the fair and proper thing to do. And eventually he agreed with me, but he didn't like the idea at first. Let me put it that way.
But you persuaded him that that was the way to
go.
Yes,
I did.
And you eventually prevailed.
Yes, a very small issue, but
right. Small victory.
A small victory.
But you take them where
you
can get them.
Yes,
you can. Do you recall another instance where maybe you were not able to persuade him and he told you what to do and you had to just suck it up?
Not really. I can't really say so. I can tell you, though, a few things that he came to me about. Mm-hmm. People may or may not know that Mike has an autistic child. And he came to me in one of my very first budgets and said, I'd really like to see something for autism in this budget. And it was the very first time the province of Ontario, any government, mm-hmm. had ever done anything for autism. Mm-hmm. And I think we started at a very modest sum of around $50 million a year, which rapidly became about $350 million a year. And I feel, you know, I'm always very concerned about those parents and those mm-hmm. young people, because there will never be enough money help every
yeah.
single autistic child in the province get to where they deserve to be. And it, so it's difficult. It's very frustrating at times. But you do what you can, and you suck it up, and you go ahead, and you try to help as many people as you can. Special education was another one that was very dear to me because of my late son, Justin. He had dyslexia. And I'm proud to say that while I was finance minister, I doubled, then tripled, the amount of money being spent on special education in the province of Ontario. And I must say that I had no disagreement with Mike about that at all. He was fully mm-hmm. supportive.
Mm-hmm. Let's pretend for a second he's not here. So tell me something that you two would have fought over when you were the finance minister. Either you wanted it in and he was saying no, or you didn't want it in and he was saying do it.
Well, I'm going to fall back on budget confidentiality, not on that I can't remember.
Oh, you're no fun.
No, I mean, I don't think there were any sort of, you know, knockdown, drag-out fights over any issue. I mean, there were a lot of, and as he said, it was interesting because the actual deputy minister was a wonderful guy by the name of Bob Christie.
Right.
And he had Mike Gurley, who, as you say, was really helpful. But Mike drove us all crazy, I think, with bright ideas that he wanted in. And some of them were things that the premier said, no, that sounds like a good idea. But at the end of the day, you know, we sort of saw it off in the middle and it made it work.
Let me try this then. How much of this, this is going to be a real capital P political question here, and I want all three of you to talk about this. We are not so naive as to think that the relative political futures of cabinet ministers is not at stake when you folks are putting budgets together. Mm. In other words, if I do this because I think it's going to be good for my future, it might have a great advantage if I end up screwing that guy over there as well and hurting his future. And that kind of stuff happens, right? Can you give us an example of that?
No, actually, I'll give you a reverse example.
Okay.
Helen Johns was the Minister of Agriculture, and she'd been long-term care as well. But anyway, and Helen had come to me in my first budget and said, I want X amount of money for the Ministry of Agriculture. Now, I mean, that's usually not, in the current environment, one of the high priority ministries of a government. But Helen had done her homework. She had a very detailed plan about what she and the ministry were going to do with the money. And I gave it to her. And they did. They did it. And it worked really, really well. So she came back the next year and she asked for another amount of money. And everybody was, yep, you're going to do it. Because she had done her homework and made it happen and politically put out a couple of fires, you know, for the government, that they weren't going to bring the government down, but, you know, anytime you can put out a fire is a good thing. Hmm. So some ministers are good at that, others are not. And so you kind of have to judge. I mean, and one of the challenges that every government has is when the poor health minister walks in the door and says, we need X million dollars for this program. And you say, okay, fine. What happened to the X million dollars I gave you last year? I mean, the numbers.
That was last year.
Oh, the numbers just, like, I don't think the Ministry of Health ever brought in a number that was the same 6 months later. I mean, it's just an incredible.
Do you remember what you spent on health in one of your budgets?
I should have looked at it. A lot. It was a heck of a lot more than when we first came in, because we promised we were going to protect the health budget at $17
billion. 17.
It's 17.
You know what
billion.
It is today?
Yeah, it's, well, today it's what, 50?
80.
80, yeah. Yes, 80, sorry, yeah.
Isn't that incredible?
Million? Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And it still needs more money. It's just one of those challenges you never meet.
Let me try this with you, because when you were Mike Harris's finance minister, you know, as you went on in the second term, you know, you're probably thinking to yourself at some point, Mike's going to leave. I might want to run for the leadership to replace him. So might that guy and that guy and that guy. And I want to do something that will help me and maybe coincidentally hurt them. Give me an example of how you did that.
This may shock you. This may shock you, but it's true.
Yeah.
I never thought I was going to run to be the premier of the province. That was never my objective, never even crossed my mind. I was quite happy being the Minister of Finance and Deputy Premier. I think I did a relatively good job in the 6 years that I was there doing that. I had retired from public life. I had a nice cushy job at Credit Suisse First Boston as the Canadian chairman. And then Bob Runciman and some of my colleagues, former colleagues, persuaded me, to come out of the private sector and go back into politics.
This is a very unhappy story because it doesn't sound like you used the budget process to screw any of your political rivals.
No, I did not. But there are always cabinet ministers, as Janet was just pointing out, there are always cabinet ministers that want more than you will be able to give them. And it is difficult because you're dealing with these individuals who are proponents, as they should be, for their particular area in government, their particular ministry. And you can't give, there's not enough money to give everybody everything they want all the time.
Okay, well, let me try it this way. When you put budgets together, did you ever think to yourself, and you can admit it, it's, as you say, it's 20 years later, no one cares anymore. Did you ever think, well, I really like this minister. We're good friends. I like what they're doing. I'd like to give their career a boost. So I'm going to help them. And you know what? This person over there, they're always nattering at me, and I don't like them at all. I'm going to try and just make their life a little more difficult.
Well, the two that come to mind.
here we go.
And it wasn't doing somebody in or doing someone a favor, but two of the more aggressive ministers, Gerard Kennedy, education minister, always asking for more. And I would say to my political staff, get him off my case. You know, because there was never enough money for education, like there was never enough money for health. And the other was Michael Bryant, who was the attorney general, who I was very fond of. And it's not a big budget. And if I could do something to help him out in his ministry with a little soupçon of something in the budget for him, I would do it. But the relationship between myself as finance minister and the other ministers ultimately was pretty good, and most of them were satisfied, at least to the extent you can be satisfied in that kind of competitive process.
Yeah, and secondly, too, I mean, you don't want to do something that's going to make another minister, like, deliberately look bad, because it's bad
I'm
for the government.
I'm so glad you raised that, because I've got a great example of where I think that happened, and you were the one who was made to look bad. You're the premier. You're the education minister. Mm-hmm. Jim Flaherty is the finance minister.
Yeah.
And he pulled a rabbit out of his hat, and I don't think you knew it was coming. Or if you did, you didn't get much of a heads up on it. Roll tape.
The minister could put a thing or two in his speech, which could be highly controversial. And in fact, Jim Flaherty, whose funeral it is today, I think actually did that to Janet Ecker when right at the end of his budget speech he said, oh, and by the way, we're going to create a tax credit for those who for parents who send their children to private schools. Nobody but a few people in the Premier's office, Mike Harris's office, and in Flaherty's office knew about it. Janet didn't know a thing about
and
it.
She was the education minister.
And she was the education minister.
Okay, yeah, misstatement by the host. You weren't the Premier yet. This was, well, Mike Harris was Premier, obviously from a show we did 10 years ago about this very thing. Okay, is that what happened?
Well, I did have some heads up. Not a lot.
How much?
Not a lot. About a week and a half, something like that, yeah.
You would have wanted more for such a significant policy change.
Yeah.
A dramatic policy change.
It was a dramatic policy. And what was ironic...
It was one of the things that ended the Conservative reign in Ontario because it was such a controversial thing. John Tory tried to campaign on it and make it even bigger. And it was a huge political issue. And, by the way, it was bad public policy.
And you reversed it when you came in.
We sure did.
Well, one of the ironic things about it was, of course, I got to be finance minister the next year. And I inherited the problem of implementing it, trying to execute on it, and which was a bit of a challenge.
Did you want to do that?
No, not the way it was done. Not the way it was done.
So this would have given a tax break for people to send their kids to private schools, independent schools, I guess some religious-based schools and so on.
And to me, one of the things I always think is important is that, you know, certainly parental choice is important, but so is accountability for public dollars. And if you're going to spend public dollars on a program, there needs to be an accountability so you know, is it working, how's it working, et cetera. You know, public education is important. I mean, as I said, I support parental choice in a lot of different ways. But public education is also very, very critical.
The budget will be read tomorrow. That speech, that budget, when is it actually put to bed? In other words, beyond which you cannot change it.
Well, I can remember a few that weren't put to bed till, I mean, literally, there were people up all night printing. The day, you know, the night before the budget. Not that doesn't happen often, but it does happen. The budget speech, I think people sometimes confuse the budget with the budget speech. The budget isn't a mass, a huge document that is tabled with the clerk of the legislature on that morning. But the budget speech is really just a pronouncement of what's in the budget, what the government wants to highlight is in the budget, et cetera, et cetera.
So the speech they can work on right up to the last minute.
Yeah, the speech.
But the budget itself.
I wrote little notes all over and quite often changed it and threw the one I had out.
Okay. But the budget itself goes to bed when, a week ahead of time?
Preferably, yes.
Preferably.
Yeah. Whenever it can go to the printer in time to be represented.
Yes, new technology, I think, has shortened that window quite a bit because I think it used to be closer to 2 weeks. But
my own experience was the numbers were locked down 2 weeks before budget.
2 weeks ahead of time.
Yeah.
Okay. There may be some minor editorial writing in the budget document, but not much. 2 weeks. About 2 weeks beforehand, it would go to the printer.
But the other reason why that piece is really important is because you have to make sure that once you know what's in the budget, how are you going to help your team, your caucus, go out there and sell it? Mm. So, I mean, that material needs to be developed and ready to go in their little packages for your colleagues in caucus so they can walk out the door that night and be part of the sales job, because that's a big piece of the budget is selling it.
And again, when Mr. Bethlenfalvy gives the speech tomorrow, he will stand up at 4 o'clock and he will deliver a speech that, what, he rehearsed in front of a mirror 25 times before giving, that people coached him on, or he'll go in there and just wing it, or how does it work?
Well, if he's a good minister, he will have practiced the delivery of that speech a lot. Mm-hmm. How much did Joe Biden practice his State of the Union address? A lot. Yeah. And it was a great delivery. It's the same with the budget speech. It's just a performance. It's not the budget, but it's the performance that explains why the budget is doing what it does and why it's important and why it's great for the province. No one remembers it. Clips are shown on news programs, but in day two, people are talking about what's in the budget, not about the budget speech. But as a finance minister, you want to do your best. It's your day. It's your performance.
It really is your day. And did you practice it a lot before you gave your speeches?
I practiced it, but I wouldn't say a lot. I often change a lot of things, you know, in handwriting, blah, blah, blah. You always get to ad lib a little bit, at least I did. And you usually dedicate the budget to somebody or some entity. I remember dedicating, I think it was my first one, to my mother, who was still alive. My dad was not at the time. And I told a little anecdote about my mother wanted me to go and talk to her and her bank manager about her finances and something to do with her house. And she knew that I had a propensity to be late when I was showing up to meet with her. And her comment to me was, "Ernie, we're meeting with the manager at 10 o'clock. This person is important. You better not be late." I was just chopped liver as a minister of finance. So there are those humorous things. I can also remember delivering a budget when I commented on, I think it was the fund I gave to the cultural institutions in the province of Ontario that they could match, a $3 to $1. And I think I put either $25 or $50 million in it. Mike had no idea this was coming, and he was sitting beside me, and he said, "Oh, that's a good idea." That's one of the anecdotes that I will always
remember. Never happened to me.
No. Well, when I did my first budget, because I was the second finance minister from the little town of Exeter, there were three women cabinet ministers from Exeter in the Harris-Eves government. But Charlie, I was the second one. So what I did was I took a quote out of his first budget and used it in my budget and had invited his whole family and the relatives and everything, because, of course, he had passed away by then, to come and sit in the gallery and introduce them and whatever. So you can do kind of fun things to make it, I guess, your budget, or to put some humanity into all the figures and printed numbers and everything else.
Did you ever do something like that?
Oh, not really, no. I mean, I have such powerful recollections of my first budget speech, because my very dear friend, John Baird, from the other side, just heckled the bejesus out of me so much that I had to stop, and he was ultimately thrown out of the legislature.
Is that right?
Yeah. He was just, my young daughter was up in the gallery, and after the speech, she said, "How could that guy do that to you?" And I said, Don't worry, he's a good friend. He was just attacking me because that's what you do on budget day if you're the opposition and if you're really angry. It was a tax increase. You promised not to do a tax increase. And he heckled me and shouted and screamed, and finally the speaker had to throw him out.
I'm glad you're over it.
I still find him a dear friend, and I'll never forgive him.
Very good. Well, we look with interest at what will take place tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. But in the meantime, I want to thank the three former finance ministers and former premier for coming into TVO tonight and helping us understand a little bit about what goes on behind the curtain. Ernie Eves, Janet Ecker, Greg Sorbera, many thanks.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.